I got to go to these meetings, you know, which involved General Westmoreland and the ambassador and all of that and so on.
As the head of this organization?
As the head of this organization. So I started a campaign, which I think was an important one. I lost it, but I think it's still important. I felt that, I mean, at that point, there were an awful lot of Amerasian children being born.
Uh-huh.
And I proposed that the U.S. military take on child support payments for the children of U.S. military.
Uh-huh.
Well, first, of course, they said, well, how can you tell? And I said, well, easily. And if you make a mistake now and then, it's still probably most likely an American serviceman, and there'll probably be a few children of Asian Americans that you wouldn't catch, but let's just, you know, do our very best. And, you know, and in a lot of cases, you've got proof, because Vietnamese women used to get temporary wife payments, papers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because it was supposed to slow down the spread of VD, that if they had this temporary wife paper, then they wouldn't go back to the bars, and if the MPs came,
if the MPs came,
you know, and caught the soldier with this woman, then she could show the papers, and at least there was showed some kind of a more permanent. Also,
they wanted to curb promiscuity.
Yeah, the women would try to have a child because Vietnamese think that children are the most precious possession that anyone can have,
mm-hmm.
and they felt surely if they had a child, their soldier would not leave them, that they would get married and, you know, and be well taken care of. Of course, the soldiers left, and then the women mm-hmm. would try to find another soldier, and or very often the soldiers would pass the woman on to their buddy. But I felt, and still feel, that the U.S. should have, when they could identify the father, should take a child support payment from his salary. Mm-hmm. If they couldn't identify him, then the military should assume that responsibility. I remember Westmoreland used to get so angry because I asked him the question two or three times in press conferences as well as in the individual
mm-hmm.
things. But that was a battle that I lost. The U.S. never provided any support for the mothers or children, and I think that's a real shame. In the mid-60s, I started getting involved in prisons.
Before we go on, Don, because I'm interested in your so many years as being concrete director.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to get to the tiger cages, mm-hmm. too.
Can you stop it for a minute?
Sure. Out of that. Anyway, I've got this back on again.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was interested in your this long service as country director and working things out with AID or keeping AID at bay or whatever. And you mentioned how you wanted in any case where it was reasonably secure to send people out into areas where they could be serving, you know, people affiliated with the NLF just as much as government.
Right.
And you know, some of the dynamics that you had, because during your term of service as country, well, I'm calling it country director or chief of party, mm-hmm. from 60 through 67, this is year of build-up. And this is years after, you know, GM's assassination, when the U.S. is trying to win this thing, and there must have been tremendous pressure by AID on you.
My operating policy was that never to allow an IVS person to work in a place where that I felt that they might be killed,
uh-huh.
you know, or where that, you know, there was serious, you know, a probability of harm. At the same time, never to say that we would not do something because it might be seen as being supportive of, in quotes, the other side.
Oh, yeah. So there's a double negative in there. You don't want them where they could get killed, but also you don't...
No, I don't want them to do things that would be interpreted as being anti-NLF.
Or pro-NLF.
I wasn't pro. I didn't see being pro-NLF as a problem because we were so pro-U.S.
Okay.
In kinds of things. In other words, we were helping people who were clearly identified with the U.S. side.
Yeah.
Therefore, I would have no problem in doing things that would be helpful to the NLF side,
mm-hmm.
as long as it didn't endanger the IVS personnel.
Right. Okay. But you just didn't want to put a person into a situation that was seen as going after the NLF.
Yeah.
Okay.
By going after them, you mean trying to be harmful to them?
Yes.
Oh, no, I would not do that.
Yeah.
And so we worked with student groups that in some cases were certainly pro-NLF. We worked uh-huh. with the Buddhist Third Force a great deal, which uh-huh. was neither pro-NLF or pro-US, but was interpreted by many people as doing things that were anti-US. We participated in, for example, I burned my draft card in a pagoda, Buddhist mm-hmm. pagoda with some Buddhist monks, to make it clear that my purpose was not there to shoot anybody, and that,
And they knew what the draft card meant.
Oh, yeah, because they had asked me about, what does this mean, burning your draft card?
Uh-huh.
And so I said, well, this is what a draft card is, and showed them mine. And they said, well, why don't you burn it?
Uh-huh.
And I said, fine.
Oh, they didn't know about burning it, or they did?
No, they did.
They
and that's
did.
Why
okay.
they were asking
So why
me.
Haven't you done this?
They weren't really asking me why haven't you done it. They said it was more that it would be fun to
oh.
do that. So I said,
okay.
Well, yes, do you have a match? And they said, oh, no. If we're going to do this, we should do it properly.
Oh, yeah.
So we had a ceremony. Well, first, so they said, you'll come back tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I come back, and they had a whole bunch of the people from the community and other monks and all of that. So we burned it, I think there were some people from the Vietnamese press,
mm-hmm.
Who kindly didn't list my name. They just said that an American had burned their draft card.
That was good.
Such and such a pagoda and mm-hmm. So on. But
well, when was this?
Oh gosh, this would. What, 65, something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Okay. So a couple years even before you resigned.
Mm-hmm.
So when is this political transformation?
Well, it was.
I mean, it begins, obviously, in 58.
58, 59, when I began to understand why people were so upset with the U.S. presence, why they were so upset with Madame Nhu and the Diem government. And then by the mid-60s, I was teaching at the College of Agriculture, and this is where the prison thing comes in, not the tiger cages, but
okay.
long before that.
All right.
The students, kept getting arrested, and then they
wouldn't
come. So
you were teaching as well as being chief of party?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was two or three times a week, I would,
all right.
I had two courses, I think,
mm-hmm.
that I taught,
okay.
One in English and one in Vietnamese. And so, the students, and then they'd come back to class, and they'd show me, the scars where they'd had cigarettes extinguished in their bodies,
uh-huh.
where they'd been, welts on their back, all sorts of things. So then they, the one time they asked me if I would go to the prison and try to get this student out of jail,
uh-huh.
And I said, this is ridiculous. And they said, well, no, it's not. You can do it because you're an American. And I said, well, what advantage does that give me? And they said, whiskey and cigarettes. And I said, what? what do you mean? And they said, well, you can go to this U.S. place,
mm-hmm.
and you can buy cigarettes and whiskey, and
yeah.
you can buy them very, very cheap.
Yeah.
And I explained that I never went to the PX, that I was philosophically opposed to that, and
mm-hmm.
why should Americans be able to do that when Vietnamese couldn't. And they said, because it will get people out of jail.
And, so, very concrete
right,
answer.
Right. And so my, you know, anyway, they convinced me that they had a better moral argument than I had.
I'd say it obviously and, superior.
So I went and bought a bottle of Johnny Walker. And they said, you got to buy Johnny Walker Black because Johnny Walker Red isn't quite as good. And a carton of
these are connoisseurs.
And a carton of Marlboro cigarettes. And went to the Biennois prison, mm-hmm. met with the prison director. And, you know, he brought out some tea and we drank some tea. And then I said, I brought you a present. And mm-hmm. put the carton of cigarettes on the table and opened up the bottle of whiskey and poured him a teacup of whiskey, put the bottle back on, and then he poured me one, and you know, and as I said earlier, I just was complete teetotaler at the time, but again, this was a bigger moral sort of thing. So we ended up drinking most of the bottle of whiskey. But in the meantime, he had brought this.
You're a teetotaler.
He brought this student out, you know, when I had explained, you know, that I was this friend of mine. I was real concerned. You know, and I was explaining that the kid came from a good Catholic family and certainly was very, very anti-communist. And
mm-hmm.
He gave me a lecture about how Americans didn't understand some of these things as well as the Vietnamese. And I said, yeah, I know that, you know, you're certainly right on that, but in this case, it's someone I know and someone that I can vouch for and have another glass of whiskey. So he brought the kid out and you know, just went involved, you know, got into a verbal harassment of this poor kid, you know, who sort of stands, you know, is there with, you know, his hands folded across his chest and his head bowed, and yeah, you know, the Vietnamese word, it's basically a word for I hear you talking, you know, kind of being ultra polite. And so at the end, you know, he said, well, here, take him. So this kid, I even forgot his name now, he kind of helps me out to the Jeep. Unfortunately, he didn't know how to drive. So
you had to drive.
So I drive back to Saigon, to the student union, you know, where there was another celebration. Fortunately, they couldn't afford whiskey. Another celebration waiting, you know, sort of this hero, the returning hero, you know, with the student, you know. And then they told me that they were just surprised. They didn't believe that I could get this guy released, but they thought it would be an interesting thing to try. And so I was a little pissed off at them.
yeah.
But then I kept doing it. And I'd really like to meet this, you know, this prison director again, because he was a real nice guy.
Uh-huh.
After the first time, we didn't go through the charade of even drinking, you know. We just drank tea together and... you know,
well,
and
he
and
might have sold the whiskey for himself.
Yeah, whatever he did, you know, saved it for New Year's or yeah,
probably sold.
I mean, I didn't
supplement his salary.
Yeah. I certainly didn't care. And sometimes he wouldn't give me a prisoner, and sometimes one time he gave me three, but usually it would be only one or
mm-hmm.
none.
Mm-hmm.
But I would always go back, even if he didn't give me any, you know, just to prove that this was all based on friendship.
So you would know, just go for the heck of it sometimes?
Just go and take him a bottle of whiskey or a carton of cigarettes or both. And
uh-huh.
And sometimes I would have names and sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes he'd just ask me if I wanted somebody this time. and it was, you know, it was just... but I would like
Didn't
to see him
Didn't he wind
again.
Up in a detox center? For all the whiskey?
Well, as you say, he probably didn't think it. And although just a sort of side story on that was years after the war was over, just back visiting Vietnam, the hotel where I was staying in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, said, you know, called up to my room and said, there's someone here to see you. And mm-hmm. so I went down and, you know, and said, you know, I was he explained I was a student at the College of Agriculture, and I said, you know, do you want to go up to the room and talk? And he said, well, I don't know. And, you know, and I asked the hotel people, and they said, sure, it's okay. So he went up, and he said, I brought you a present. And he brought me a bottle of whiskey, and he said, I owe you this.
You know, he was one of them.
And he was one of those people that I had gotten out of jail long, long ago.
Oh, my.
So
how did he find you?
Well, there's a group called the Prison Association, Ex-Prisoner Association in Vietnam. People that, you know, were in jail, you know, under the old Saigon government, mostly under Thiel.
Yeah.
And they meet, and the guy that gave me the maps to find the tiger cages is very much a leader among this group. And also some others. Lei Kong Zhao is very much involved, and then Lei Van Nui, and several of the other people that you know, were friends of mine during the war years and spent time in prison.
So it was not hard for him to find you.
No, you know, so when I go, usually I go see some of these people, and then the word spreads around.
That you're in town and staying at such and such a place.
Yeah.
And then it's good of him to remember. Had you remembered him at all? Was he at all familiar?
No, he wasn't. But as you say, it was nice to, it was a nice little touch. You know,
oh, it was a wonderful touch.
20, 30 years later.
Sure, yeah. So how does this get you interested in, well, I know how you get interested in the prisoners because you're working with the students, but how does this feed into the tiger cages later,
well,
or does it?
Well, only indirectly. The tiger cage thing came about indirectly because of that, and the tiger cage thing was after I left IVS, but because I was pretty well known among the students and the Buddhist and all of that, and I was still teaching at the College of Agriculture after I left IBS. Anyway, the five students, prisoners, were released from the tiger cages as an example to other students.
Okay.
And they came to see me and said they wanted to have a meeting with some other students, you know, and so on. And they wanted a room to put themselves on display, basically. And I said, well, how many people will come? And they said they thought maybe there would be 25 or 30 people, you know. And so I went to the dean and said, you know, could I get a room for Thursday afternoon or Friday afternoon, whatever it was. And he said, well, the only thing we have is the anatomy lab. And I said, well, that's okay. You know, because I thought, well, that's fine, you know, that people can walk up and down through the aisles, you know, where the equipment is, you know, set up, you know, in the, you know, lab style at a college. And I had counted on sort of word of mouth in Saigon, you know, that it just is like crazy. So there, instead of being 15, 20 people there, there were 15, 20,000 people there. That whole...
What?
The whole courtyard of the university was just packed with people. I mean, first of all, you know, the tiger cage thing was something which both the U.S. and the Saigon government were denying that they even existed. You know,
correct.
There was no such thing. Well, suddenly to have word spread that there would be five people, five paralyzed people from the tiger cages at the College of Agriculture on Friday afternoon, come see them. I mean, that just spread like wildfire. To not only, of course, the, you know, the students, but also to the police and so on. So, so the police came with their tear gas and all of that. It was my first experience in an enclosed room with tear gas, you know, kind of thing, you know, because they shot it through the windows. And I still remember this Vietnamese woman student, girl student. She was smart enough to carry a wet
handkerchief or something.
Washcloth in this case, and lemon juice. So she, that's how I learned the best thing. I mean, if you're ever caught in tear gas, the best thing to do is to have a
a washcloth with lemon juice, wet washcloth with lemon juice on
it. In a little baggie so that you can keep it wet.
Right, right. So
and
she
always
had,
wear tennis
so
shoes
they were passing,
rather than leather shoes for running.
Yeah, they were passing the washcloths out to people and so on. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they said, well, you know, you're an American, and the police certainly won't search your house. So the best thing to do is we'll take the five students to your house, mm-hmm. and they can hide there until things get quiet. So, you know, I said, okay, fine. And so we brought them over to my apartment. Mm-hmm. I was on the sixth floor walk-up. The first five floors were the first floor was a dance hall. Then there was four floors of brothel, and then my apartment. And so people could never, police could never tell whether someone came to see me, or the
workers,
or the workers.
Yeah.
And so anyway. In the middle of all this, just by chance, was when Tom Harkin, who was a law student at the time at mm-hmm. Catholic U here in Washington, mm-hmm. he had gotten his congressman to take him as a congressional aide. So I get this knock on the door, and we're putting together this report that Judy Danielson was with Vietnam Christian Service. She and I had translated the report. We were stapling it together. We were going to send it to...
About this confrontation at the university?
No, about the tiger cages, that these things existed, mm-hmm. what they were, where they were, et cetera, et cetera.
All right.
And so we had gotten a Vietnamese friend who was a secretary at AID to photocopy all the, or mimeograph, I forgot which it was at that point, but anyway, to give us copies, you know, like, I think we had like 400 copies of this 10-page report uh-huh. that we were stapling together. We had some in Vietnamese, some in English. Uh-huh. And one of the good things that AID did was to replicate all of these copies about this unbeknownst to them.
okay.
So we're stapling them together, collating and all of
uh-huh,
that.
Uh-huh.
Get the knock on the door, everybody, you know, they drag the people who'd been in the tiger cages, you know, back into the other room, you know, and locked the door, and I opened the door, and it's this young American, and you know, he'd read The Unheard Voices and wanted to talk to me. And this was almost midnight, because he had to do the running around with the congressional people all during the day.
You probably said, but what year is this?
This was 1970.
70, okay.
And so then he got really interested, and I trusted him. You know, you never knew who to trust in Vietnam and, mm-hmm. in the 60s and 70s. So then everybody comes back out, and he meets all these people. It must have seemed like a rather crazy kind of situation. You know, here there's about 30, you know, young Vietnamese all sitting around on my floor, you know, collating and stapling and singing and laughing and mm-hmm. all of that.
On top of a brothel.
On top of a brothel.
And a dance hall.
Right. So anyway, Loy, Calvin Loy, the student leader, convinces him that he ought to go to see these tiger cages.
Mm-hmm.
But he needs an airplane to do it. Mm-hmm. So he says, well, I'll convince the congressional delegation to go out. And he was only able to convince two of them, but he got two and an airplane, and that's how we flew out to the tiger cages and did the expose and that, mm-hmm. You know, and all of that. But it comes out of the earlier stuff, you know, from my IBS days of getting people out of prison, mm-hmm. you know, that whenever there were I also used to, in both IBS and later World Council, I always went to the Seventh-day Adventist Hospital and got fungicides by the carton, because one of the biggest problems for people in prison is that they get, you know, real serious kinds of jock itch. I mean, it's, you know, the...
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just...
Okay.
Well, you're in the prison, you can't bathe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's all sorts of funguses there already.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these are funguses that for IVS people will take sometimes 5-10 years mm-hmm. after they've left IVS to get rid of.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for the people in the prisons, it's even worse.
Sure. Keeps on growing and growing and getting deeper and embedded mm-hmm. into the skin.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so to step back just a bit.
Mm-hmm.
When you have volunteers, whoops, we got a knock on the door. I'll pause this.
Yeah.
Pause there. Now it's off pause again.
Okay.
And where were we?
We basically finished on the tiger cages, I think.
Yeah, but I was...
it's more of a after IVS kind of story.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think Mark has already talked to you about that before.
Perhaps.
A while ago.
And there's... actually, I don't think I did talk about that in the article I did in the IVS Experience book.
But you have that Prisoners in Vietnam book.
Hostages of War.
That has a lot in that too.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I didn't think we had to dwell down
right.
there.
Okay.
But sorry to say right. dwell, but we didn't have to go right. into that in a lot of detail because it's been pretty much covered. But I was more interested. You know, as you know, the part of the study is how did IVS function, and that's in relationship to AID. And if you've got people working, you know, not just yourself, but others working with students. Or if the, you know, IVS did in some sense work with third force Buddhists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you as country director have to deal with AID people who don't want deviation from, you know, the political line. How do you protect the organization from that? Keep it from selling out?
You know, with a lot of difficulty. Let me go backwards.
Sure.
You go back to when IVS started mm-hmm. in Vietnam. It started, its first year there, we were really, I think, really sort of floundering around, you know, trying to decide what we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Cagle, for example, was doing some really good work on drilling wells, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. he just sort of said, you know, to heck with, you know, with all of the systems and, you know, plans and all of that. I'm just going to do my thing. I'm going to go and dig wells in villages, all of wherever a village wants a well, I'll dig it. So that was, you know, so that worked fine. When I got there, you know, and some other people were trying to do odds and ends of things and so on. When I got there, we sort of were put, just begun to work under an AID person by the name of Howard Harper. He said, look, you know, these are people with a lot of energy.
The volunteers.
The IVSers, you know, mm-hmm. IVS has a lot of potential for help and that sort of thing. And so he sort of became our protector almost. Between us and AID. I mean, he was AID, but was sort of in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, if we were in Saigon, we'd all go over to his house for a cookout. And, you know, and he was a real... You know, he was really very enthusiastic about IVS, very helpful, mm-hmm. you know, with IVS.
So he wasn't in that bureaucratic mold.
Not at all. And in exchange, his whole responsibility was setting up a series of agricultural experiment stations.
Yeah.
And the idea was to put one or two IVS people on each of these stations and to give them the general responsibility of here are 22 varieties of sweet potatoes. Test
As
them
you
out,
did. Yeah.
Find out which ones are best, and then start working in the villages.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it worked well. After he left, I think it was two things that happened. One is that the people sort of taking over were much more bureaucratic. That was point one. And secondly, AID itself was under much, much more pressure to get results. And the big sort of theme, you know, was, you know, to work as a team, you know, and to get IVS brought into the team.
About what years would that have been?
That would have been more like beginning in 64, sort of.
So he was there for quite some while.
He was there for maybe 4 years from the 58 to 62, 63 period.
Okay.
And then he moved. You were only allowed 4 or 6. I think you were allowed 4 years in a country, and he stretched it to 6 or something like that.
Yeah.
And he was there like from.
And he was the head honcho of the one area of AID?
No, he was an agronomist, the head of the agricultural program, Mr. Phippen, Bill Phippen, supported him and allowed him to do that. And it worked very well.
Yeah, no,
it was a good relationship between IBS and AID, and it was the way aid should work, I think, he liked the Vietnamese liked him, you know, he worked well with the experiment station directors, he worked well with us.
Yeah. But he leaves about 63, 64,
something
and then,
like that.
And then there's also sort of a change in AID.
And there's a change in AID, yeah, so you're moving toward...
this is both personal and institutional.
Yeah, personnel and institutional, yeah.
Okay.
And in both cases, making it harder for IBS, you know, that all American organizations should be part of the team, that our purpose there was to show what young Americans could do and, you know, and all of that.
So, was this, to interrupt, as I'm doing here, I spoke to Bob Plummer. Wait a minute, he was, might have been loud. This is for you to agree or disagree with. But Bob Plummer also pinpointed 64 as a pivotal year in terms of many things. But he said that because Diem was assassinated in November of 63, that he thought that the pressure was on the United States, now that Diem was gone, that we are going to take over and we're going to make Vietnam a lot better because we've got this guy and his corrupt brother and that obnoxious sister-in-law out of the way. And for that, we're going to have to pump in all the stuff and get everybody on board and push the pins into the map and make sure that all the projects are developed.
That might have been part of it, yeah.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was, I mean, another
way. He put it better than I did.
Yeah, and another way of saying it, too, is we didn't have many options left, you know. We just had to, I mean, politically it was so important, you know, to, Johnson and, Kennedy then Johnson.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I mean, but it clearly that period after the assassination of, I mean, before the assassination of Diem, it was kind of a stuff that was happening at the U.S. Embassy level, you know, way up there.
Uh-huh.
Didn't have a lot to do with IBS. Some, but not a lot. But after 64, after the assassination of Diem, yeah, there was much more, you know, Lansdale was brought in, you know, he was a big team player, you know, getting everybody involved.
I thought he was gone by then.
No, I think he was in... I'd have to get the years. You know, I have real trouble with years.
Okay.
But I know he came in with one kind of philosophy, you know, of the team players, everybody working together. But not so much you have to... I mean, there wasn't the same kind of pressures, you know. I mean, he basically... got people to do things through friendly persuasion.
Correct. Okay. Yeah.
And then Killen, the head of AID and so on, and much more of a militarist type guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, he came in and sort of wanted to do all of this bureaucratically, and put, for example, IBS directly under military command. You know, kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so, my. I didn't realize it was so.
So that was
such
that
a
was,
clamp on
oh,
you.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the things, that was one of the reasons why the group of us wanted to get control of the Council of Voluntary Agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this, I still remember the meeting we had with Ambassador Bunker. I mean, I think there's a report of it in the clippings there. There were four of us that met with the ambassador.
This is the council of the NGOs.
Right. It was Elizabeth Brown from Foster Parents.
Okay.
Paul Leatherman, I believe it was, from the Vietnam Christian Service. Myself, maybe one other person.
Uh-huh.
And so we went to protest the pressure to be part of the military. And I remember Elizabeth Brown made sort of a famous statement. She said that the purpose of the voluntary agencies and of the military were completely opposite. The military was here to kill people,
uh-huh.
and the vol agencies were here to help people.
Uh-huh.
And Ambassador Bunker just blew up. I mean, the only time I've seen him really lose his cool. He just was incensed, you know, at that. And so then...
sounds true to me.
then the U.S. Embassy denied that there was any, any real problems between the embassy and the Vol agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day after the denial was when Gene Stolzfus, myself, and Willie Myers, Don Runk, resigned from IVS, you know, with our letter to President Johnson. You know, so it was, you know, all those things were all happening in, like, in the month of September 1967.
Mm-hmm.
The job of being a country director or chief of party was complex because you had both the security worries, you know, getting supplies out to people in a country at war.
Yeah.
Dealing with the trauma of being in Vietnam for young Americans, you know, who'd never traveled out of this country in their life before. And the U.S. military and political pressures to prove that we were young Americans helping the people, showing that, you know, putting a good face on young Americans, because you had the U.S. soldiers there doing, you know, pretty atrocious kinds of things, you know, everything from throwing pennies at 5-year-old Vietnamese kids to pushing farmers out of helicopters, you know. So they wanted some people there who were, you know, to give a good image to America.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't want to play that role. I mean, we wanted to be nice people, but we didn't want to be used as the image of the real Americans I think Dave Gettleson who said, you know, we didn't want to be Band-Aids on an amputee. And we knew that, you know, that we could only help, you know, a very small number of people and, you know, sort of be an example and you know, try to give people some hope during the middle of a war. But we didn't want to be combatants.
No, of course not.
So this all of this led to real tensions, and I think in some ways, the U.S. government, with me, their frustration was that they felt that if I would just agree to let them use the volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as part of the team, then the volunteers would go along with this, which may or may not be true.
Probably not.
but it certainly was their view, you know,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
you know, that if you can't get the head of the program to go along with this plan,
you know, how are you going to get the volunteer out in Quang Mai, up in Quang Mai province, to go along with it? And so you had both the pressures there and then in Quang Mai province, or in Tua Tien province, or wherever. You had the provincial advisors there, saying, well, you got to kick this guy out, you know, because he's causing trouble, or he's, you know, he's working in a village that is in an unfriendly village, or he's spreading rumors about defoliation,
mm-hmm.
or he's claiming that the chickens of Farmer Nguyen were killed by defoliation, and he told that to the press, and we all know that that wouldn't happen. And that, you know, and then, you know, IVS people, you know, they get all tied up in little controversies from the military perspective. Like in Kanta, was Kanta Bin Long? I forget which. It was Kanta. Anyway, an island on the Mekong River.
Uh-huh.
It was perfect for growing sugar baby watermelon seed. You know, sugar baby watermelons did very well in Vietnam. And there was a higher price for them, just really, really nice watermelons.
Uh-huh. They're good.
And so we were introducing them in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And we had all of the farmers on one island agreed to grow sugar baby watermelons. And this was good because of the whole cross-pollination kind of issue. Well, the watermelons got about the size of a baseball, and the U.S. Helicopters defoliated along the edge of the Mekong. The defoliation floated over and killed the watermelons. There was a law in Vietnam, or a regulation, I'm not sure which, that said that if farmers, you know, lost their crops, they would be, you know, paid back, you know, whatever the value of the crops. So we had, so the IVSer was a Cornell graduate, you know, he had a camera, and was
this you?
This was Les Small.
Oh, okay.
So he got pictures.
Uh-huh.
He and Jim Lin, both of them, they got pictures, you know, they got, you know, detailed descriptions, you know, from the farmers. They measured out the size of each farmer's field, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we go to, it was Vin Long, I'm pretty sure. So we go to the provincial advisor's office, and we'd already been to the province chief's office. You know, and we said, you know, that the farmers' sugar baby watermelons were all defoliated. And, you know, and, you know, show him the photos of what happened. And, you know, and he said, well, how much damage? And we said, we estimated $10,000. And he said, well, the whole goddamn country is not worth $10,000. So we said, well, now, this farmer, had, you know, such and size a field, and, you know, there were so many watermelon plants, and
mm-hmm.
they were killed, and each watermelon would produce seven, each plant would produce seven, you know, we're starting on this, you know, he said, God damn it, there is a war going on in this country, and you're here telling me about sugar baby watermelons. I mean, you know, what's wrong? You know, and he was so angry, you know, and we never got a penny for the farmers. And he never understood that the war was about sugar baby watermelons, you know.
Yes, you know. And farmers' lives.
Yeah. And so we were always in those kinds of confrontations, you know, with mm-hmm. the military. I mean, you know, and in a way, it's kind of interesting that the IVS confrontations with the military started out with things like eating their popcorn, you know,
at the movies that they get invited to.
And, you know, gradually became things like
compensation, you know, for farmers, and
compensation for farmers,
prisoners
writing letters, the, you know, tortured, you know, and in some cases prisoners that were captured by the U.S. military turned uh-huh. over to the Vietnamese, you know, and so we're digging out the Geneva Conventions on Warfare, which state very explicitly that the capturing body
is responsible for what happens to the prisoner, even if the prisoner is turned over to another entity.
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know this. Yeah,
yeah,
really?
That's part of the conventions on war.
Okay.
So we're explaining that, you know, and here you've got these, you know, kids from the military perspective, you know, coming in and, you know, and arguing the Geneva Conventions on warfare, you know, and saying, you know, you are violating, you know, the conventions on warfare, and this is pretty serious stuff.
Yes, it certainly
and,
is.
And
it's a ground for a court martial or something.
And when the military wouldn't listen, then we go to the press, and then we are, you know, have the gall to take the press clippings from the New York Times back to the military officers and say,
that is a little chutzpah.
You see, we were right. You know, this is a serious thing, you know. I don't get the fuck out of my office and get out of this province.
Yes, yes, if not country.
Well, they did try to kick several people out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always a dilemma for the embassy, because the embassy wanted IVS to kick them out of the country.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And IVS wouldn't do it.
Right.
So the embassy would have to violate the authority of the voluntary agency.
Uh-huh.
And then would have the argument with the Council of Voluntary Agencies, you know, which was all these different organizations, you know, and would have to have that taken before, would know that the chair, myself, would be taking that to the council,
mm-hmm.
you know, for discussion, and then it would go to the press,
uh-huh.
you know, and of course the embassy was saying, you know, that these agencies are very much in agreement with U.S. policy and we're working as a team.
And you weren't. Not if you were chair of it, you could get the...
See, we thought that we were doing what was right for Vietnam,
uh-huh.
and we also thought it was right for the U.S. And our analysis of what was right differed.
Yeah, of course.
You know, they felt that winning the war was the all important task, and we felt that preventing hunger, preventing torture, preventing bombings of villages, and, you know, and all of that was what was important,
uh-huh.
you know, and that...
or at least pursuing the war in a different manner.
Yeah, yeah. And you see, in many ways, I think that my going from hawk to dove, if I can use those old terms,
uh-huh.
was partly that I went from hawk to, I mean, when I basically accepted whatever was done,
uh-huh.
to saying that this is the wrong way, you know, that uh-huh. you'll never win the war by fighting it cruelly, you know, you
uh-huh.
should be working with people and helping people, and then they'll like you and be on your side, to eventually, you know, feeling that, you know, we shouldn't be there at all,
uh-huh.
And that, you know, there was no way that we could, you know, ever win, except that I always felt, and this is certainly true, that once the war was over, you know, it would be quite easy to be friends with Vietnam.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that certainly, you know, when Ho was still alive, I mean, he had always made it clear that he was ready to cooperate, and I always felt, and that in terms of Vietnamese views of China, that they would always want a strong protector, and if they could get two, that is the Soviet Union and the U.S. as
mm-hmm.
protector, that they'd be very happy with that.
I think a lot of Southeast Asians feel that way,
yeah.
too. Perhaps not as keenly as the Vietnamese, but they certainly feel that way. So, the refugee program, though, that's perhaps one of the most ambiguous kinds of programs.
Oh, we had to deal with.
With.
We always had.
Jay Worrell and I talked about
that
for a while.
Yeah, we always had big arguments about that. philosophic arguments.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah, of course.
The two sides of the argument were, one, that I remember John Taylor, J-O-N, up in Fuyan, in Tuiwa, was in a village and heard on the military intercom, I guess he was with, you know, the military were there and so on, and he heard on their radio the comment, sort of went something like, you know, well, we're here in this village, should we refugee them?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was, yeah, we just got a refugee man in, go ahead. And the refugee man was the IVS volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So the village, the villagers were all brought in near Tuiwa, and the village itself was burned, and John was told to take care of them.
Uh-huh.
You know, and at that point, John could only say, you know, hello, how are you, how many children do you have, you know, kind of thing. And not at all, I mean, that was his first week, you know, he had just arrived. So he decided he would go to the site, the village site, the original site, and see if he could get some idea of how he could, in quotes, take care of these refugees, what he could do for them. So he gets into a helicopter, and you know, the military says, sure, you know, you come on up and so on. While he was there, they found two or three, I forgot which it was, farmers. And they took them to sort of like a knoll. They blindfolded them and had them, and they put concertina wire at the bottom, sort of halfway down or something, and made them run down this knoll. And this was part of interrogation, you know. And sort of they were trying to find out where the VC were,
uh-huh.
you know, like where the tunnels were or something
like that.
So they had them run into the concertina wire. Then they took them back up to the top of the hill. And then they had removed the concertina wire, but had forced them to run down again. Of course, they didn't know where, you know, what was down there. Of course, these are farmers, you know, and they had the, you know, the black shorts.
Sure,
you know, and
yeah,
all
they've
that,
got
you know,
exposed bare legs.
Yeah, it's horrible. You know, so then they put them in the helicopter, and they keep indicating to them and in sort of a mock way, trying to push them out of the helicopter.
Uh-huh.
But didn't actually, as I understand it and remember it, they didn't actually push anyone out, but, you know, just scaring the living shits out of,
out
of these guys. So that was one side of the argument. I, the IVSer, was there. The village was burned. The people were mistreated. I am responsible. IVS should not be working in refugee work.
Mm-hmm.
The other argument was John Paul Vann came to us and said, "Would we help to resettle the refugees from, you know, from the Iron Triangle?" That they were going to have a major military operation. He didn't tell us where, but he said, "You know, I want you to free up three or four, whatever it was, IBSers to help resettle them.
Uh-huh.
You know, help them get their houses built and, you know, and all of this." And I said, "No. You know, we're not going to do this. We've just gone through all these experiences." Well, they made the refugees, and this was...
Anyway,
this is where Jay Wirl worked, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So the second argument was, you know, well, General Westmoreland is not going to make military decisions based upon whether there's an IBSer around or not, you know.
Yes.
He's going to make the refugees.
If he wants to bomb them, he'll bomb them.
That's right, and we should be there to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's so much truth in both arguments,
yeah.
You know, and it was just went on and on and on, and you know, so I think our policy basically was to say, if asked, you know, we would always say no, you know, don't do it, we can't, we won't take care of them, and then to always help if we could.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what else you could do.
Yeah. Right. No, I don't know what else you could do either. I have no, you know.
You gotta
call Gene Stolfo.
Yeah,
so why don't we
call?
Put this off for a while?
Give me 15 minutes.
I'll give you longer than that if you want. I mean, after all, you gotta call Gene. now that the call is complete, I forgot to ask you once before, when you were describing something else, you said that AID every once, or the, maybe not AID, the embassy, just put it in that general term, wanted to kick out one volunteer at one time or another. For what sorts of things?
Well, I mentioned with Dave Nesmith, it's because he wrote a letter.
That's right. That was one example.
But
that was rather...
The thing that was appalling to the embassy was that it even got to President Lyndon Johnson's desk.
Mm-hmm.
He scribbled a note to Ellsworth Bunker, what's going on here?
Yeah.
It was always, I think, around the issue of either writing home, writing public letters, you know, that were anti-war.
Okay.
Or that it was doing things that the embassy, and particularly the military advisors in the various provinces, felt were encouraging either to students to protest the war,
mm-hmm.
or that the IBSers were distributing goods in areas that were considered to be pro-NLF.
So, but they would want volunteers sent home for that reason.
Yeah.
Not just a stern warning to the organization.
Well, I mean both.
Okay.
You've seen the documentation on even what was it, as early as about 63, 64, somewhere mm-hmm. along in mm-hmm. there, where aid was trying to get me kicked out for not
right.
being willing to be a team player.
To toe the line, and obviously
which
failed.
Which was basically that I wouldn't kick people out,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of that they wrote a letter that was critical of the war, or because they worked with students
work,
who later
yeah.
demonstrated, or and so on.
Who were some of those volunteers, or is that not?
Well, Paul in who was up in Da Nang. Paul, it was either Gold. I think it was Paul Goldberg. I think his last name was Goldberg.
Uh-huh.
One of the major culprits from their perspective. Certainly like Don Runk,
mm-hmm.
and who was it? Someone that who was in Fontiette that upset them. Got his name. I mean, it was like this, like a half a dozen examples of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was particularly either that, you know, they were working, you know, like with students, and the students would demonstrate, and I guess in one or two cases, IBSers were even seen in anti-war demonstrations, and,
oh.
you know, that kind of thing. So, it, you know, and with me, you know, it was the first... You know, that I wasn't seen as a team player, wouldn't kick people out, you know, if they said, you know, that they that they were writing these nasty or naughty, they weren't nasty letters, they were naughty letters or something like that. And I, challenged the whole way the U.S. was carrying out the war, you
mm-hmm.
know, in terms of that, that bombing a village, I argued, made far more Viet Cong than we killed.
Mm-hmm.
That when you defoliate a farmer's sugar baby watermelons or mm-hmm. sweet potatoes or what have you, that farmer is going to join the other side. When you take a student in for questioning and interrogation with use of torture, that you not only make that student pro-NLF, but that student is going to talk to everybody else that he knows.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a feeling was like if all of us could just stick together, you know, and have a
circle
solid,
of wagons.
That's right. That and there was no understanding that it really was pretty unimportant what I thought. That was the important thing was what did the Vietnamese think.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no understanding of the Buddhist movement, the student movement. Much less, you know, the way farmers felt. you know, the way anybody would feel if they watched a young man in their village, you know, dragged out of a house and shot on the village street. And that happened all the time, you know, and you know, as IVSers, you know, we saw dead bodies deliberately left on a village street to terrorize,
to make a point,
and terrorize the village. Mm-hmm. And we argued, and I think we were right, that that disrespect for the dead is at the least going to alienate that person's whole family, no matter what they think, and probably alienate that whole village.
Because Vietnamese culture.
But, you know,
beyond just a human thing.
But, you know, of course, in the end, you know, I felt that we had long, long passed the point where that we could make any, we as a country could make any positive thing in Vietnam, and we should just get out and let the Vietnamese work it out. Of course, we did, that's what we did, but a million or so lives later. You know, which was,
and not by a conscious decision on our part, but by force of circumstance.
Right, by saying in 1973 that we had won the war, and the war had been Vietnamized, and we were leaving. Of course, we didn't leave.
One person that you mentioned, Van.
John Paul Van,
How was he to work with?
John Paul Van was very very pro-IVS, you know, in the sense that he always wanted IVS volunteers, you know, to be working in the province, the provinces. He was the head of the U.S. program for the Third Corps around Bien Hoa. And always wanted IVSers there. Understood what our objectives were. You know, would have liked to have had us go further, you know, in terms of a more explicit support of the war effort. But, you know, at the same time, didn't push us as a lot of the other Corps commanders did.
I think he understood why he couldn't push it.
Yeah, I think so. He's not at all a hero of mine, but in terms of his relationship to IVS, I have no no problems at all with that.
Yeah, well, I asked you about the working relationship, not about your ideology.
Because
I think ideologically, you probably would not be birds of a feather,
but
you did have to flock together for work things, if he at least gave you space.
Yeah, no, he did. He did. More than most U.S. officials, and certainly in a different country at a different